Hi, y'all. Katie Parker, alcoholic. Okay, I'm going first this time. I'm going to go as quickly as I can through this this idea of the way I see the four step and how it's played out in my life with plenty of stories. Because I think I'm a huge fan of the directions. I'm a huge fan of understanding the directions. We've been very fortunate to, you know, be involved with Lorenz, Gary Brown, Mark Houston. I never met Joe Hawk, Dan Sherman, Big Book Awaken. There are several people that have influenced this. So I just kind of compiled it. And all my life, I've been pretty much a teacher in my field of work. Not a school teacher, a fitness teacher, and but it's one of those things that I like to be able to teach, and if I speak your language, I can give you some more stuff afterwards. My card's here, and it's got my email address on it, and you just have to email me, send me all your stuff, and then that way you'll have some of the cheat sheets, as I call them, the notes. I don't think worksheets are something we should get into because, you know, it's the big book, so I just have laid it out the way I like it. You know, the 10th step, if you think about it, it's the idea of watching for resentment, selfishness, dishonesty, and fear in a much is much different than waiting for it, right? So we're trying to always be on the, you know, the front end of something instead of on the back end of something. So the watching for it is what, if you ask me, the 10th step is 4 through 9. It's combined, right? The many different types of inventories we do. And then the 11th step is checking my work at the end of a day. Sometimes that gets into a whole nother deal. I'm not going to go there right now. I also like to say spiritual growth is like maturity. So in your 20s, you're bulletproof, right? I mean, you'll do the stupidest stuff you can do. I mean, that's just what we do in our 20s. We have a ball. And in your 30s, you start to mature and start to kind of go on the direction of who am I? What am I going to be in this world? And then your 40s, you kind of look at it, and I think the 40s are the best, if you ask me, where you just stand there, you're in the best physical shape you can be, your life is looking pretty good. And this is a summary of people, not everybody. But and then in your 50s, you start to really look back at what you've done. In your 60s, you're chilling. And if you're like me, you're still going to get Medicare. So there you go. But and so spiritual growth is the same way. 0 to 5 is spiritual maturity in sobriety time. You know, people say you're as old as you are when you're getting sober. I don't necessarily agree with that. I believe, because I can promise you at 5 years old and 5 years sober, I'm very different. But I think between really 5 and 10 is another real spiritual growth. But then between 10 and 20 or 7 and 20 are what I call your teenage years. And man, oh man, is it hard to tell anybody anything. You know, I know. Yeah, I've read that. I'm already there. And you're like... Okay. Let's just assume you might not know everything. And then between 20 and 30 is really unbelievable. It's pretty awesome, but it can be painful. These walls, they're all different. Everybody hits a different wall at a different time. And you got to hit the walls because that's what causes growth. Do any of y'all ever remember having growing pains as a kid? Oh, my God, your legs would kill you. And it's the same thing. It says in the book, right between the third and the fourth step, it says, though our decision, what decision was that? The third step decision that we're going to go on with this work was a vital and crucial step. The word vital means key to life. That's a pretty big deal, right? Your vital signs. And this is very important, you know, and people are like, don't rush anybody through it. Let them take their time. Wait 90 days. I'm like, well, that's not what it says, you know, but because it's just too dangerous. And it could have little or permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Blocking us from what? The sunlight of the Spirit. Deep down inside every man, woman, and child is that fundamental understanding, God, whatever we want to call it. For me, it's the still, quiet voice. And I become to rely upon it. Remember what I said, that pause when agitated or doubtful? I see that as a promise. I see that as something that I am watching for and looking for. Then, of course, during prayer and meditation, it says when we face indecision, we're asking for an intuitive thought or decision. No actions taken. relax and take it easy. Then throughout the day, we pause when agitated or doubtful, pause, ask, remind, and say. So I'm asking for an action. Should I go to Target or should I run by Charlie's office? I need that information. I don't just take for granted, because you get that list and next thing you know, you're flying from one place to another and you missed all of God's work. And it says our liquor was but a symptom. Now, I didn't see that line till I was almost probably 19 years sober. I remembered remember, I didn't read the book till 17 years. I opened it once. I do remember that. But I relied on you telling me. Joe would read me the big book, you know. But one of the things was, is it, my alcohol was but a symptom? I remember thinking, what do you mean? Alcohol's the problem, man. And I get that. Today I see it clear as a bell. So we have to get down to causes and conditions. Column two, column three. Causes and conditions. This is what this whole thing's about. Cause and effect. Cause and effect. How does Katie show up? Because I show up differently than you show up. So when I get upset, what do I do? So that I know what I'm watching for in the tenth step. I've got to be able to understand the you know, as Roland Hazard said, the inner workings of our mind, wasn't it he that said that? Except then I got to realize I'm completely powerless over them. I've got to have the help of God to get me to get through this. My life is a demonstration of my inward conditions. The fourth step is just a consideration of how Katie shows up. Once again, I said I'm assertive, better than I've ever been, which is just nothing short of a miracle. And I'm very clear that when I get scared, I take a step forward. And if I'm in a really challenging spot, it can go ugly. But it just doesn't hardly happen anymore. Although Charlie and I are facing some tough stuff right now, I've lost my cool. Let's put it that way, and I'm really like, wow, God, and I am spiritually fit, and I'm still losing my cool. So that happens too. Don't think it doesn't. Don't get your barometer judged on that. Some days are better than others, right? And always working with the ego turned inward, right? The person who's stealth. Remember, we got to teach that person to speak up as opposed to me shutting up, right? They're both very different. It's just how you show up. And then it says no regular inventory usually goes broke. I mean, I love that. That means you take more than one. And here's something Mike and I were talking about. And not to embarrass you, but this is a really good bead. How many of you guys have actually written a piece of inventory on anything? Fear, conduct, sex, resentment in the last 2 months? Oh, that's good. That's a good number. There are more of them are sitting on that side if you guys want to move over there. One of the things is I didn't write a piece of inventory after my major house cleaning for 15 years. Now, keep in mind, I was doing group therapy. It wasn't like I wasn't digging into Katie's, the inner workings of my mind. I mean, if you've been in group therapy, it sucks, especially when somebody's on the hot seat and you give some feedback and the light goes to you. You're like, whoa, 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 whoa. You know, I mean, we were doing some deep, deep work in all of this stuff, but it was self-fixing self. Right, I just was getting knowledge and knowledge and knowledge. I was not getting what the book is requiring, and that's crucial. So one of the things that I like to do, the majority of my inventory is written in my evening review, and I like to write a lot of inventory in my evening review. Sometimes I don't even get through a third column before I see what a hypocrite I am. And that's a good thing, because all of a sudden it's like, wow, okay, God, I clearly see it. It says we're on a life or death errand. Mark used to make a big deal of that life or death errand. He said, you know, people say sometimes I'm just a lot, you know, maybe I get too excited about this. Life or death errand is a big deal, right? It says next we launch out on this course of vigorous action. The first step is, which is a personal house cleaning. If we are to launch out on a course of vigorous action, what is that course of vigorous action? I used to think it was 4 and 5, and then I thought 6 and 7 went together, then I thought 8 and 9 went together. Today I understand it's 4 through 9. It's just like a golf swing. You're to do these things quickly. Why is that? Because the ego rebuilds at an astonishing rate. You all of a sudden you swallow and digest all these large chunks of truth about yourself, about your family, about all these things. And if you don't go out and make those amends within a week, you are pissed off at them again. You know what I mean? You have not done what you need to do. when we're looking for selfishness in the three different types of inventory, I think this is also important. In resentment, you didn't do what I wanted you to do, period. That's why I'm mad at you. Fear, I'm afraid you're not going to do what I want you to do. And then the harms inventory, the conduct inventory is I feel guilty for what I did, right? So if I'm feeling guilty, it's still about me. I'm still always making it about me. And I watch this with especially mothers. I'm not so much with dads, I don't know. But with mothers, we feel guilty for the way we raised our children or we showed up as a parent. And so we quit parenting and we try to become their friend and we don't make them have consequences. And I'm telling you what, as that is the worst thing you can do for a child, if you ask me. You got to make your kids have consequences. You got to show up as the parent. You are the teacher in that situation. And if you don't do it, then you just, you know, throw money at it or you do something like that because you feel guilty. So it's still a very selfish act. We're on a fact-finding and a fact-facing mission, right? The fact-finding is my job. The fact-facing is your job. I personally, I heard somebody one time say they don't do much of this in the inventory process, and I don't know how you wrap your brain around that because I got to know the whole storyline. So I'm going to ask you a ton of questions about your father's upbringing. You know, like Mike was saying about it was, who was that, your uncle that you were talking about or your dad? The way he was brought up, and then you start to look at it.
Yeah, my father.
Yeah, and you start to look at it, and you begin to realize he took care of his drunk grandfather. Yeah, I mean, that's a big deal. And yet we hold him accountable for the way he, you know, did us or raised us or whatever. I mean, these are some things that if we don't go back and start to look at the circumstance of what this person went through, we cannot have any sort of sympathy for this situation. And I really think we have to look at the fact that it's not a fault-finding mission. It's a fact-finding and a fact-facing mission. And I'm telling you, you can get an early sobriety person immediately to see that they're a hypocrite. I just did a piece of inventory with this chick, and she is mad at her husband. But here's the deal. She was at treatment, which don't even get me started, for 15 months with two kids at home. I can't even wrap my brain around that. If I was the parent at home, I'd be pissed. And if you come back in and you don't like the way I did it, I'm really mad. And so you have to point out hypocrite. You know, you have to show them, oh, my God. You know, I mean, to me, it's like, first of all, why would you separate people that long? I don't think that's the healthiest thing because separation is not necessarily what heals us. Doing the work heals us. Separation, not so much. You know, because to me, you come back into the environment and it's game on. You know, you walk back into that family. It's an effort to discover the truth about the stock in trade. I had another sponsee, and these guys give me permission to share these stories. I opt out of telling their name. That's not necessary. But I had another sponsee that was a very powerful woman in the business sector. And somebody sent her an email. And on this email, I mean, they just tore her character up. And then they signed it anonymous, which personally I think is so chicken shit, if you ask me. I'm like... Really? Oh, Mr. Big, you know, big man in Cowtown, and you can't even sign your own name. And she showed it to her husband, and he was like, I can't believe somebody would do that. And, you know, she called me with the 10th step, and I know her. And some of that stuff was true. It was a terrible way to present it, but it was true. So it's an effort to discover the truth about the stock in trade. So I said, because I got to do it, you know, understanding and effectiveness, and I said, you know what, is it possible that some of what they said was true? And she said, yeah. I said, well, it really sucked at how they went about it. I'll give you that. That's ridiculous. Chicken, come on, stand up for it. Once again, all this electronic stuff, you can say whatever, you big old, you know, keyboard gangster, you know. But the truth of the matter is she did the work behind that. So you see, her husband did the right thing. He stood there on his white stallion, said, I can't believe somebody would say that about my wife, you know, which was the right thing. Because if he said, well, honey, some of that's true, well, then we got a whole nother problem, right? So this is about swallowing and digesting large chunks of truth about ourselves, right? This is not about gently letting you down and da-da-da. I mean, you can do it with understanding and effectiveness, but you must look at it from an entirely different angle, and that is the angle of the other person. That's what it's all about. It says, one object is to discover damaged or unsaleable goods, to get rid of them promptly and without regret. I think that's a very important line. You are to uncover, discover, and discard. You're not to uncover, discover, and lather yourself in self-pity, right? Which, honestly, if you leave an inventory and you're down in the blues, you missed it. You missed the whole point. You went from self-righteous to self-pity. You go from self-righteous to, wow, God, this is going to make me a different person. I am getting ready to really... Swallowing and digesting is painful. It is painful to see the stuff that's the truth about me. See, I did that to me, not God. I came into this world pretty darn pure, and I just added all this stuff. It's always a process of subtraction, not addition. On page 75, the second paragraph says, we will be delighted in the fifth step, right? And that means, so we're supposed to get rid of it promptly and without regret and then be delighted after we swallow and digest. It's trying to get us to see that this is what's required. It's a lot, you know, how many women have had children in here? I mean, was that a fun experience? Oh, my God. You know what I mean? I mean, the first one I had in the hospital back in the 70s when it was terrible. It was just a terrible experience. And then the next one I had 10 years later, and I decided to have a home birth because it was going to be, you know, totally different. And holy smokes, midway through that thing, I thought, what was I thinking? This is so flipping painful. You know what I mean? And that's the key. That's what I have to remember is that when I'm getting a tattoo for you guys, how about that? Let's go to a tattoo. Or you guys could have a urinary tract infection, you know. But, I mean, a tattoo is pretty goddamn painful, especially if you have it on your bone, you know, on any sort of bone. Well, it's painful, but you know afterwards you're going to be like, check that out, right? So, I mean, it's the same thing that happens with it, right? If the owner of a business is to be successful, so that's just us guys that want to be successful, he can't fool himself about values, right? What are your values? What are your family values? What are your work values? What are your AA values? Values are really, really important to understand what you have, because this is where the old ideas get twisted up, very twisted up if you ask me. And so, because remember, our old ideas are good. Right? I'm a good mother, I'm a better mother. I'm a good AA, I'm a better AA. I'm a good driver, I'm a better driver than you, right? I mean, it's always coming at me like that. So where are these old ideas in a resentment inventory? They're in the self-esteem, pride, ambition, security, personal relationships, sex, and money. And so what I like to say is with your self-esteem, it's the value you've placed on you. It's not a feeling. So it starts with an I am. This is where Dan Sherman kind of taught me this information. And it was interesting because we did a two-hour inventory in Santa Monica. And he said, I said, Dan, man, I'd love to see that in that process. You know, unfortunately, we've lost him. He passed away. But I said, I'd love to see that process. And he goes, well, write a piece of inventory. And I said, you know, could I have Charlie write the inventory and I observe? Because I didn't really want to swallow and digest. And you're not going to believe it. It was on the China berries. Oh. God dang China berries. It's a long story. but it was fascinating to watch this guy boil this down. Because to me, do I think inventory is important? You bet. You want to change, put pen to paper. Not typing, not texting. Pen to paper. Spiritual stuff happens. So your self-esteem is an I am statement, the way I value myself. I am a good mother. I am a bad mother. Right? It can be either one. Your self-esteem can be high or low. Your pride is no one could, should, or would, right? So you could start out with no one should act that way. So it's the way I think you value me. That's a tricky one. Your ambition is what I want to have happen, and your security is what I need to have happen in order for me to be okay. So that would start out with an I want and I need. And personal relationships are your deep-seated beliefs. You know, say the inventory's on my husband. My deep-seated beliefs would be about husbands. Husbands should value their wives. Husbands should talk kindly to people, you know, to your wife. Husbands should take responsibility for the children. You see what I mean? Now, don't get me wrong. Those all sound good, don't they? Do you think I've done those? No, I have fallen very short in all those areas because that third column's going to see where I'm such a hypocrite. It's just not accurate, right? I am a good mother, but I could get my kids in here and they could point out many times I was not a very good mother. So you see that third column is about me seeing the hypocrite in me. That's the beauty of the third column. We searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure, right? Now, this is where we're starting to get into the fourth step. Being convinced that self manifested in various ways is what had defeated us, we consider self's common manifestations. And that's where we got to get really down to that fourth column. And I love, Mike always does so fantastic in that fourth column. It's such a in-depth example of how he shows up with his thinking. To conclude others were wrong was as far as most of us ever got. Think about that. That's just the blamer. You're at fault, not me. I got a little bitty part in it, da-da-da-da-da. I always like to say we did columns 1 and 2 on the bar stool. Did you guys ever have your favorite bar you sat at? And people would say, what are y'all talking about? We're solving the problems of the world, okay? Leave us alone over here. We're doing good, you know? Because, I mean, we had an opinion on everything. The usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. And that's just it. That's just the foundation of what we do. It says, but the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. Remember I said, the victor only seems to win at war, although our moments of triumph are short-lived. I remember confronting my dad at 10 years sober, and I did a lame amends to my father. And we had a huge fight. I left home at 15. I never went back, but he and I certainly kept a relationship of some kind about 3 months after the dust settled. And you're usually battle with the child you're most like, right? Parents, you usually will battle with the child you're most like. If you're more like your dad, you and he go at it. If you're more like your mom, you and she go at it. That's just the nature of it. It's not exact science, but it's pretty common. And so my dad and I would go at it. Well, we were visiting my sister when she was living in Wisconsin, and this was a big deal that we were all getting together. My mom died when I was young. My dad remarried a ton of times. We had live-in housekeepers. It was a fiasco. But I wanted to tell my dad how badly he screwed up. And I remember thinking, I just can't wait till he gets here. I'm going to tell him. We're sitting on the couch. He's an ex-NFL football player, so he's pretty stoved up. You know, little fire plug. And I said, you know what, Dad? You know, la, 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 la. And then I even told him how old I was when I was sexually active. That's some tacky stuff. No parent needs to know when that date happened, okay? And, I just pelted, because I was doing all that codependency group therapy, right? And it was just like, my dad caused me to be this way. And it was terrible, terrible, terrible. And I am a shining example of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? I'm 10 years sober. And my dad tried to turn his head, and he was so stiff. You know, and he goes, Kate, I effed up, man, I effed up. And he said it 3 times in a row, and I remembered thinking, God, I thought that was going to feel so much better. I didn't even know it was in the book. And the next thing you know, I said, well, I guess I just ruined the whole weekend, you know, because now I'm going to make it more about me. And I said, I'm sure you're going to go tell Evelyn, which was my stepmom, and she was the one that stayed the longest and, you know, to the end till my dad died. And when I finally, I'll explain that when I do the amends process, but when I made that amends to Evelyn, I said, I guess Dad probably told you what happened at Liz's house. She said, no, he never told me anything. I knew something had happened, but he never told me. There you go. I swear to God I'd have told you he said something. Never did. So that's what we do. We see a picture, we take it, and we tell you exactly what happened. I know what you're thinking. I have no idea. I'm so out to lunch. See, life's, I am. I'm telling you, I think I know what Charlie's thinking of or what he's doing over there. And he looks at me, I go, what's going on? He goes, nothing. I had you 9 miles down the road and blah, blah, blah. My sponsor had me ask that question several times. And I got nothing, Katie. See, life's not coming at me. It's coming from me. It's always coming from me. That's why 10 and 11 are going to take on such new meaning, right? We turn back to the list, for it held the key to the future. Think about these terms, the key to the future. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. We begin to see that the world and its people really do dominate us. Once again, turn statements into questions. Do you believe that? Or are you just so chilled you get through life fine? Good luck. If that's the way you are, I'm impressed. That is not the way most of us are. In that state, the wrongdoings of others fancy to real have the power to kill. I mean, these are some pretty solid words they're using. We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? See, I can't just go to acceptance is the key. It does not work. Now, it works in early sobriety sometimes, right? Some of this stuff that worked in early sobriety, saying the third step prayer, saying a prayer, works. But it quits working after a while because of your progress and where you're growing. It says, this was our course, right? We launch out on this vigorous course of action. We realize the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. This is what we call the sick man prayer. Though we didn't like their symptoms, column two, the way they disturbed us, column three, they, like ourselves, are sick too. We're trying to see the hypocrite in ourselves. I'm judging you for something that I did exactly the same thing, but I'm going to tell you why I was justified, why I did it. I could be either person in this play, right? And so the way I like to look at it is the book says, where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Though the situation had not been entirely our fault, we disregard the other man entirely. Now, I'm telling you, when I call Marty to rat Charlie out, let's be real clear what I'm thinking I'm doing. Marty, man, I got a problem with Charlie. I'm really ratting him out. You're not going to believe it. Not going to believe it. And then she goes, well, hon, we need to disregard the other man entirely. I'm like, wow. You go there every time. And I'm thinking she's not, you know? So it says, the inventory was ours, not the other man's. We saw our faults. We listed them. We placed them before us in black and white. And so the way I like to look at a fourth column, I'm going to go for about four more minutes here. The way I like to look at a fourth column is, I like to break down selfishness into five ways that self shows up: self-righteous, self-reliant, self-pity, self-seeking, and self-centered. Because I want to know exactly how I show up when I'm in this situation so that I am well prepared what I'm getting ready to walk into. I'm not just willy-nilly, you know, hand on the doorknob and say a prayer. When I know I'm walking into a dicey situation or one that, you know, somebody that I don't like, you know, some, not my family members, although my brother and I, boy, we can go into an ugly argument pretty quick. We got in a huge argument. He came to my house. We didn't see each other for a while, and just we're close, but we're not physically close. And we got in a fight over the salt shaker. And I mean, it got ugly because we're the Osterjellers. We just yell and scream. That's how I was raised. Who yelled the loudest won? And we are going at it. And Charlie goes, Katie, you know, and he's trying to break us up. And I'm like, what are you doing, man? Do not try to break us up. And Charlie goes out of the house. I'm like, you know, leave us alone. And after Mike and I were done screaming at each other, we both went, wow, I feel so much better. So do I, man. We had to clear the air there. And I go outside and I ask Charlie, I go, what were you doing? Because his family doesn't do that at all. They just shove it down and shove it down and shove it down. So they don't do that at all. And he goes, I'm not used to having a man yell at my wife. Well, I just went, well, thank you. Didn't see that, right? I thought, well, that's just because your family just shoves it down, shoves it down, shoves. And then he said that, and I thought, well, there you go again, right? So self-reliance is I'm better than you. Self-righteous is I'm better than you. Self-reliance is how I show up running the show. Self-pity is poor me. Self-seeking is how I make getting my way happen. Self-centered is why I want it to go my way. And then dishonest is, of course, lying, omission, and delusion, right? You absolutely lie. It cracks me up. People say, I don't lie. I'm like, oh, you just lied saying you don't lie. Yes. It may be a little white lie, but we do. I'm going to be there in 10 minutes. I'm clear I'm going to be there in 20, you know. And then frightened are our old ideas, right? And then Mike did such a beautiful job with the fear inventory, right? The fear inventory is the fear and why I have it, the truth, self-reliance, how I show up, and then I like to write a little love letter from God. I just love love letters from God. I'll get way more into that in the 10 and 11. And then, of course, once again, the sex inventory is a conduct inventory. Once again, Mike covered that beautifully. I think one of the coolest things about the conduct inventory is you really get to see, how do you show up as a sponsor? You know, I can arouse bitterness and jealousy and suspicion very easily. You know what I mean? And I'm pretty clear I'm doing it. That's not a hard one after you've been sober a while to see. And bada bing, I'm done. Mic's up.
Oh, my light is on. I'm still functioning here. We're spraying a lot on you here. You know what my favorite third step prayer is? It's the one Dr. Bob and Bill used. God, I've made a terrible mess of my life trying to run it myself. Would you please take it and run it for me? Simple, precise, and to the point. That was where it came from, Oxford Group, and that's the way. I got to remember, Bill and Bob didn't work these steps. They got sober working the Oxford Step program and devolved from there. And all of this is good, and all of it is great because it makes us exercise our minds and as Katie was saying, all that self-reflection. But the danger for a guy like me is I've been, I liked it back in the 80s and 90s. I'd like to build my own computers. I used to hack my own phone because I wanted it to be able to do stuff that the Verizon didn't want it to do. And I was always looking for the magic trick, the back door, the formula, everything else. If I know this backdoor thing, then I can have what I want. And I loved it. I was doing a weekend retreat up by Notre Dame, and we had a cute sister that came and did the kind of orientation of the place to start the weekend. And she says, now I'll fix it so you don't have to ask. A lot of people ask, what's it like being a sister in a place like this? And she said, I'll make it simple for you. No money, no honey, and you don't get your own way. And I think that's the way it is that so much of God's able to use my motivations, but how much of it really is about getting my own way or fixing what I created trying to get my own way here? I get to look at that. 6 and 7, I hear all kinds of complaint that there's not more written about it, you know, only two paragraphs and however many words and all. 7 is just where I have my relationship with God. Because it's necessary for me to have a relationship. And I'll tell you how that was made clear to me. I was out in a trout stream up toward Boulder, Colorado with Pritz once, and it's a beautiful afternoon, and we're throwing the flies out, and the fish are biting. We can't keep the trout off the hooks. And I start talking to Don, and I says, you know, I've worked these steps to the best of my ability, and I seem to still have every defect I started with. What's going on with that? And Don had that little smile. He said, well, Mike, he says, the first problem is just what you said, to the best of your ability. And then it went on. He says, what are you doing? What are we doing here? Hell, we're fishing. He says, yeah, but that's not really the point. We don't need food. We're catching these fish and turning them loose and all this. This is about you and I spending some time together and talking and really having a relationship with each other. And I realized that my defects are where God and I have my relationship. And Sandy Beach, it was just time, bing, 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 later ran into Sandy, and Sandy was talking, and he said, I got to ask myself, how much time would I really spend with God, and how much energy would I put into that relationship if God actually removed my defects of character? See, it's kind of... I got a BMW. That BMW's sole function is to keep me at the dealers. I don't mean that it breaks down or anything, but it's. I get a text, hey, come in for this. Hey, goodness, come in for that. They want a relation. They designed that car purposely to keep me in relationship with the dealer. Now, I think God's at least as smart as a German auto engineer. If God wants a relationship with me, do you suppose that he set this whole deal up so I'm going to always have a reason to come home? Those of you that are parents, don't you love it when your kids come home? And, I hear some cynical laughing out there. Yeah. Well, look, I got to tell you, at my very worst, my parents were happy to see me. It's proof of life. And one of the things Don told me, actually, when I started speaking at some conferences and going places, he says, I never want to hear that you blew off the Al-Anon sessions at any of those conferences. The longer you're sober, the more your problems are going to look like Al-Anon problems. He didn't tell me to join Al-Anon. And he also told me how to, as an alcoholic, to go to an Al-Anon meeting. I go there and I shut up. I don't tell them that they write the fourth step the wrong way. I don't explain to them, you know, as he put it, haven't you already done enough harm? And so when I was finally, because I have this attitude of smug superiority that I'll sit in the Al-Anon meeting and, well, if you write that inventory the right way, I mean, yeah. But eventually, I got the attitude because instead of taking their inventory, if you would, I started to hear what it. I saw the pain in the faces. I saw and realized that pain had been put there by people like me. The genuine grief and hurt and harm. And I managed to use my anger to sweep that aside. Oh, you're just square. You don't understand. You don't want me to have a good time. And, you know, all of that. And as Prince explained to me, he said, you know, he says, what was it like to have you for a kid? What was it like to have you for a brother? Oh. We don't have senior skip day at our high school anymore because of your brother. Ha ha. And I was gone. My siblings had to live with that and all the other stuff. And Don finally summed it up. He says, you know, after I've heard it all, He says, you were just a terrorist in your household. Nobody could feel safe and secure. They had to put their, I'm taking my sister's babysitting money and using it to buy kegs for my boy, my friends, you know. And I think I'm a cool dude. And that gets brushed aside, and we laugh at it. You go listen to the people that are hurt, and they aren't laughing at the jokes. I mean, part of my lead used to be describing because my parents didn't buy me the car I thought I deserved, that my dad bought my mother a new car for herself instead, and I got drunk with my buddies and cut the top off that car. Yeah, he got those good friends. Hey, you can't have the vet you wanted, but you, at least you could have a convertible, you know. I was a terrorist. I drove people insane. If they overreacted or something, I can remember waking up. I was in my parents' garage. It's Sunday morning. They're going to take the other kids to church, and I'm laying out in the front seat of that car, and they come out in the garage, and I just remember my mother screaming, "Don't hit him, Art, don't hit him." And now I find out he was trying to manage, as a 15-year-old, a drunk grandfather. What do you think that felt like? The ultimate failure as a parent and everything else. Now there's a, our book talks about face and be rid of. I have to actually face what it is I did and what the consequences are. My mother never, my father was dead when I got sober. My mother was still alive, and she was delighted I was sober. Obviously, but she never, ever wanted me to describe myself as an alcoholic. She just winced any time I did, because she heard when I said I'm an alcoholic, she heard I'm a bad parent. And I was going to debate that with her and educate her on that. And I was told by Don to just shut up. I've done enough harm. If she doesn't want to hear alcoholic, you don't make her hear alcoholic. So yeah, now this is, we do this, we face it and be rid of it because so we can be rid of it. And the idea that we're somehow, these defects are going to go away. I heard it, Ram Dass once was talking, and he didn't use the word defects. He said, my demons, I have today all the demons that I ever had in my life. He says, but instead of tigers clawing at my flesh and ripping me apart, they're more like kittens that play at my feet. And I like that image because I think after time, if we will treat them with this program, they don't disappear, but they're softening. Maybe some of you had the experience that I had. I went to a class reunion. I forget which one it was. It was the 30th or the 40th, and I saw a bunch of people that I hadn't seen for 30 or 40 years. And you know what they said? Boy, you haven't changed a bit, have you? Yeah. The world knows. I kid myself. You have no idea that I'm a spiritual guru these days. And I've written many inventories and said, you know. you're still that guy, you know. I'm cleaned up. The edges are smoother and everything else. But the reality is, I'm still the guy that cut the top off his mother's car, because, you know, getting what I think I deserve, or I'm afraid I don't deserve it, is still in there. But it's useful to God if we'll turn it in another direction. And the impact on others and the impact on me isn't the same. So, my Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me. What would all mean? The good and the bad. See, that's the part that got to me. I said, well, is this good, Mike? Is this good enough, God? Have I done it good enough, God, for you to care for me, to love me, for me to be as good as the other kids? I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character that may... Those are the defects of character that are in the way of my usefulness to God and God's kids. Not the ones that look bad on my spiritual resume and all that stuff. Yeah. So I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character that stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out here from here to get what I want. To have life turn out the way I think it should. Now, grant me strength as I can go out here from here to do your bidding. And so that's a prayer of real surrender. Compare the language in step three, in the third step prayer and fourth step prayer. Third step prayer, aspirational. I'm going to give this a try. And I'm going to get started writing an inventory. And here, okay, I'm not negotiating anymore. You can have all of me. The good and the bad. And that's a wonderful place for me to have that relationship. Because for me, it's the one place I've stopped negotiating. Well, God, can I get some time off for good behavior on the, you know. That's the deal here. And step eight's real important. Because that's where I get free. I get free in step eight. And when I get free, the only decent thing I could do would be go to the people that I put in spiritual bondage and see if they are interested in being free. I'll wind up with a story here. I say it's a story because I used to be sure I knew what was true, but today I know it's a story. I think that's something Bill got. Our stories disclose. We're not intuitive truth tellers. You know, we're novelists, short story people. Back in the late 70s, I was got in a relationship with a really neat woman, and she had two young kids when I came along, Summer and Erica, and they'd just been blown off by an alcoholic dad, and he was the real alcoholic. He drove a Harley and wore leathers, and did all this stuff. The last time she and the kids saw him, they came out of the grocery store. They were sitting in their station wagon, and he came up with a length of chain and smashed all the windows out of the car, left them covered in broken glass, and rode off into the sunset. And I showed up driving a new Mark IV, wearing a cashmere jacket with a bottle of Bordeaux under my arm and a gram of cocaine in my pocket. And it looked like it was really a good deal, right? You know? Yeah. But here's the truth. I was just the alcoholic upgrade. Yeah. Because those kids still went through the terror. They just went through it in a nice house. We were together 5 years, and of course, I eventually dumped her and all this kind of stuff. Here's an interesting thing. Jan was in the hair business, and the one thing that kind of still stays with everything is she still trims what's left of my hair. And she comments on AA every now and then, and she says, "Well, you can tell your friends that if they have trouble believing in God, that I can actually get you in a chair leaned back with a straight edge near your throat, and you get out of that chair alive. And if there wasn't a God, that wouldn't happen." So anyway, one of the first things I, when it came time to make amends, I knew I needed to make amends to, obviously, to Jan and the kids. And so I went to Jan, and I did what we do, you know. I said, you know, that I'd been horribly wrong, and then I did what Don early, he says, "Look, amends aren't about talking, they're about listening." If you think about it, most of the people I've made amends to, one of the greatest harms I did is I never listened to them. And so what I have to do is I have to tell you enough to know that I've given the harm I've done you serious consideration. But then I need to listen, because I don't need, this is not a negotiation. I'm not making amends for the harms I think I did to you. I'm doing for the ones that you felt I did to you, because that's where real damage was. And God already squared that up with me in 8. So I got to that part where I said, "Well, is there anything else?" And she says, "Well, I can tell that you're a good dad." See, because I was bringing that two-and-a-half-year-old stepson from my sober marriage in there. I'm going, "Yeah, good dad." She says, "And that really pisses me off. My girls deserve that from you, and you didn't give them anything." And she went on and on and on to tell me just how the cow ate the cabbage. And she and I squared up. And I said at the end of it, I obviously harmed the girls. And they're, by this time, I think Summer was 13 and Erica was 11. And so I said, "Well, obviously I need to do something with them." And she says, "I'm not sure I want you to have anything to do with them. I think you've done enough harm there." And so I talked to her some more, and she says, "Okay, here's what you can do. If you want to," she was skeptical, "if you want to, you can write them a letter, and if they're interested in having anything to do, you know, do with you, that'll be up to them." And so back here, here was the letter, that an ancient letter. This was actually done on a word processor. Dear Summer, I'm writing you to do what I can to set right the harm that I did during the years that I was in a relationship with your mom. I've chosen to type this rather than phone for two reasons. First, my handwriting is pretty hard to read. And second, because I want you to have something tangible that you can look at when life may be treating you rough. To tell the truth, I'm tempted to let things just lay because your mom tells me that you have some good memories of the time we spent together. Part of me says, why mess with that? The best answer I have is that I love you, and I'm certain deep in my heart, whether you know it yet or not, I've done you harm. I'm sure that you're aware that during those years we were together, I was an active alcoholic. Let me be very clear that this in no way whatsoever relieves me of responsibility for my actions. I used drugs and alcohol because they were the only things that I knew that could give me relief from the constant fear I felt. Fell over at her seventh grade birthday party from tooting too much stuff and was part of the harms. I was drawn to you and the family because I desperately wanted to love and be loved, but I was also scared to death at the prospect of being responsible, especially for others. Emotionally, I felt like I had one foot on the gas and the other on the brake. I'm sure that it was hard for you to figure out what's real. Is the real Mike the one who wants to love me, or the one who pushes me away? You weren't crazy, I was. You were a wonderful, lovable child, and you had every right to expect consistent love, emotional support, and parenting from me. What you got was fear, chaos, confusion, and abandonment. I want you to know that I didn't fail to give you those things because you were unlovable or undeserving, but because I was a sick and frightened man incapable of giving. If you feel emotionally ripped off, it's because you were. If you feel abandoned, you're not crazy, you were. I know at some deep emotional level, it's hard not to feel that if you were really worthy, valuable, that these things wouldn't have happened. Please believe me, this just isn't so. You are worthy and deserving of love then and now. I failed you. Summer, I hope you'll accept my heartfelt regret for these and the unlisted harms I've done you. Should you ever want to talk about this, please give me a call. If I can ever be any help to you as a friend, I'd be honored. P.S. I'm also sending a similar letter to Erica since my actions have also harmed her. And what I've come to find out over time is most kids in a situation like I put those kids in, they would rather believe that they're crazy than the adult that's supposed to protect them is crazy. You didn't see that. I didn't do that. Here, have a little something to help you sleep better. All that stuff. And kids are different. The Erica letter was a little bit different because Erica was the younger of the two girls, but Erica was emotionally probably the older one, you know. Summer would go around singing, I know I'll never fall in love again. And Erica come up, put her hand right, Summer, you're such a sap. You'll fall for anything a guy tells you, you know. This is one where they were six or seven. So different personalities. And so the response from Summer, it took a while. But I got invited to her graduation. And I went, and that was nice. And I got in touch with some of the family again, and good enough in that fall after the graduation, we got word from Arizona that Summer always called him Bio Dad, the motorcycle dude. He died the death I could have easily died. Died hemorrhaging from esophageal varices on a couch in a flop house in Tucson. And I got a call from Summer, and she said, you heard about BioDad, right? And I said, yeah. She said, you remember that letter you sent me? I said, sure. She said, that was the letter I always wanted to get from my dad. But since he'll never be able to send it, I think God had you send it for him. See, we don't know the game we're playing in when we're doing it. I'm trying to clean up my mess as a jerk, and in the process, I participate in some healing from a guy who met the fate I could have easily met. And it goes on and on, and the relationship answered. And Summer liked the God, please teach me about love too. I went to her wedding, and the little card from Summer, and just kind of give you a feeling for it. She says, here, Michael, thank you so much for sharing my day with me. It seems like just yesterday you were chasing us around and bopping us with those foam bats. Those were such great times. See, she remembers great times. I'm glad that you were here to see me all grown up on my special day. It wouldn't have been the same without you. Hope your holidays are wonderful. Please keep in touch. Love and kisses, Summer. And the guy she married was a investment banker, and they went to London and spent a little while there. And then she got pregnant with her first baby. And of course, she wants to be with mom when she has that first one. And so they come back to the States, and little Aiden James is born, and I get to be number three or four person to hold him. And a wonderful thing. And then later she had Dylan, and I was doing a retreat in Hawaii in 2012. And I got a phone call, and it was Summer. And she said, it apparently I've gotten something else from my dad. I apparently got the BRCA gene, and they tell me I have breast cancer, and it's fairly advanced. And we started 2 years Mayo Clinic here and there. Fortunately, her husband had excellent insurance, and she was able to get the best of everything. But at the end, the people at Mayo told her that it was time for her to go home. And so when she was near the end at home, she was in her bedroom in a hospital bed, and everybody was taking their turn going in and saying goodbye. And little Dylan was 7 at the time. And he says, I want to go see mom. I want to go see mom. So let him go in, and he asked for, can I have a cup of water? I need a cup of water. And he went in, and everybody were kind of looking through the crack in the door, what in the hell is Dylan going to do? And he goes over to his mom and puts his finger in the water and drew a heart on her forehead. And he came out and he said, I've just baptized mom. Would you like to too? And I saw so much that that this young girl that I'd known, had, who had taught me so much about love, had obviously raised her kids that way too. And so, while Summer's no longer with us, the love goes on in the world. And Aiden's a freshman at the University of Arizona now, and Dylan's about ready to graduate in another year from high school. And see, in the end, it's people that die, not love. Love is the one thing that we have that will go on and on and on. And we don't know what the results are when we set out to make amends. But if I'm willing to participate in God's world, it turns out better than anything I've ever had in mind. So we'll talk more about amends. I would say one more thing. I've had a lot of experience over the years with sponsees and some people I just got referred to me that where you're making amends to kids. And it's all very age dependent. You talk to a 10-year-old different than a 15-year-old, than an 18-year-old. And it rolls differently, but they all seem to benefit from some kind of written approach to let them settle it. Some of the worst results I've seen is where we go get in a step workshop, we get all wound up and we're coming out, we're gonna make amends and everything else, and we go vomit a bunch of stuff on a 16-year-old's lap that they're not ready to hear. One of my close sponsees, son and a daughter, and the son made, you know, he was cool with it, dad pretty soon and making amends, and the daughter, it was a couple years later, and she said, okay, I'm willing to listen. And she just fried his ass. And, you know, and here's the deal. I'm talking to Bob and says, you realize, of course, what she didn't want and the reason she waited to tell you that, she knew that years ago. But she didn't want you to go out and get drunk and make it her fault because she was mean to you. So she held her fire. Actually, it's a compliment. She believes you're going to stay sober is the reason that she was able to let you have it with both barrels. So this is where working with somebody with experience and a little bit of a light touch with some of this stuff, this isn't like going and paying MasterCard the $5,000 you owe them. That's a letter and a check. This is a different deal. And this is a wonderful place for expand our relationship with God and to participate in some healing. So let's have some dinner here, I guess, pretty soon.